Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part two of the Pantagraph of Friday, January 8th, 2021. We will begin the reading of part two with some obituaries. Richard Dick M. Bailey, August 28th, 1930 to January 5th, 2021. Richard Dick M. Bailey, age 90, of Bloomington, passed away at 11:58 p.m. on Tuesday, January 5, 2021, at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. Private family services will be held. Entombment will be in Park Hill Mausoleum. Kibler Brady Russman Memorial Home in Bloomington is assisting the family with arrangements, and memorial contributions may be directed to First Presbyterian Church of Normal. Online condolences and memories of Dick may be left for his family at KiblerBradyRussman.com. Estelina R. Gee, July 26, 1915 to January 3, 2021. Estelina R. Gee, age 105, of Circleville, Ohio, formerly of Bloomington, passed away at 9:05 a.m. on Sunday, January 3, 2021, at Pickaway Manor Care Center in Circleville, Ohio. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Entombment will be at Park Hill Cemetery Mausoleum in Bloomington. Kibler Brady Russman Memorial Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Memorial contributions may be directed to First Baptist Church, 2502 East College Avenue in Bloomington, or Heartland Hospice, 116 Morris Road, Suite B in Circleville, Ohio, 43113. Condolences and memories may be shared with her family at KiblerBradyRussman.com. Jeanette Lee Bryant, April 16, 1941 to November 21, 2020. Jeanette Lee Bryant, age 79, of Naperville, died November 21, 2020 at exactly 5 p.m. Her family was beside her, holding her hands when she took her last breaths and departed this realm, a favorite word of Jeanette's when playing words with friends. And we're going to return to some state news here. This story is headlined, GOP Lawmakers Call for IDES Reforms. Staff and fraud issues seen as hampering state jobless claims. This is a Capital News Illinois story, Dateline Springfield. House Republicans are continuing to criticize the Pritzker administration as the Illinois Department of Employment Support works through ongoing staffing and fraud issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Since handling a historic number of unemployment assistance claims at the outset of the pandemic in March, IDES has added staff, changed processes, and implemented additional measures to prevent fraudulent claims. Some House Republicans this week continued calls for additional measures to be implemented, such as moving staff from other state departments to assist with the overload of unemployment assistance claims, implementing more anti-fraud measures, and holding public hearings to discuss issues at the department. It is unacceptable how the governor and the department have responded to this crisis that they themselves have caused, Representative Mike Marin, a Republican of Fithian, said Wednesday. It is my hope that someone at the administration cares enough to listen to our ideas and to start a dialogue. IDES officials pushed back on criticisms offered by the Republicans Wednesday, stating that it is not possible to move employees from other state agencies without substantial training, and that many of the anti-fraud measures being proposed by the Republicans are already in use by the department. We are working hard to respond to an economic crisis and stand up five new complex federal programs while battling fraudsters who have used stolen identities to file for benefits nationwide, said IDES Acting Director Kristen Richards in a statement. Richards said the department was already short-staffed as a result of years of budget cuts, which left IDES ill-equipped to handle the unprecedented numbers of claims last spring. The current employee headcount is roughly half of what it was 10 years ago, she said. And I'm going to read some things from the opinion page now. This is the view of the Pantograph editorial board, an editorial that reads, "We are better than what we have shown." Let us call it what it is, a mob action, a riot, an act of sedition. A group of protesters inspired and encouraged by the ongoing fiery post-election rhetoric from President Donald Trump, both from his public appearances and his ongoing clusters of tweets, invaded the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. For the first time since the British accomplished the feat during the War of 1812, invaders breached the White House. While those outside backed the invasion by saying that they were marching on the People's House, the protesters inside were showing contempt with destruction, demolition, and theft. An individual was shot inside the building, the first shooting in the building since 1958. This was not making America great again. We are better than this. There's no equivalency argument this time of there are bad people on both sides. In the event that the reports of leftist agitators within the crowd are accurate, those violators too should face the stiffest penalty. All involved in destruction of federal property or assault on law enforcement officers should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. That is what the president tweeted in July, at least. Trump has done nothing since the election, and little in the months leading up to the vacation, if we're blunt, destroying his followers' faith in the election system. His mentality left an electoral victory or loss a win-win. If he won, his followers could be praised for overcoming a stacked system. If he lost, well, he told us they weren't going to let him win. He loaded the explosive, lit the fuse, and has spent more than 2 months trying to get it to burn faster. His action led to hundreds of felonious acts by hundreds or thousands who spent the entirety of 2020 decrying and demanding punishment for the very behavior that they were exhibiting. Let us be clear. No one has a monopoly on the ability to feel outrage. But it's disappointing that instead of condemnation, too many people want to engage in whataboutism. No one has a monopoly on that argument either. They started it is the weakest argument in life, let alone politics. Challenges and lawsuits are fine. Election rule laws are complex. That's why those decisions are argued by lawyers and decided by judges. We leave the jobs of interpreting the law to judges. It's a process that has worked for well in excess of two centuries. If decisions in 60 court cases aren't enough to convince a person that the right decision has been made, then we have many more problems we need to address. The courts are the key to the post-election debates. Dozens of judges have made decisions that have gone against President Trump's legal team. Judges refuse to hear some cases. Judges don't make those decisions based on convenience or position on the political spectrum. They evaluate the laws, and when deciding against hearing cases, they have evaluated lawyers' filings and been found wanting. If we need to go somewhere other than the justice system, then we have many more problems that we need to address. You are entitled to your opinion. You are not entitled to your own facts. We are better than this. We have learned about many election-related facts, traditions, and laws that weren't covered in class for those of us lucky enough to have taken civics at any level. These laws have been in effect for decades into centuries. They weren't enacted in 2019 in a grand conspiracy to undermine the election. But when we can't agree on the facts in front of us, especially when the President of the United States fails to acknowledge anything that puts him in a bad light, let alone disputing apparent facts, then we have many more problems we need to address. We are better than this. And I am also going to read a George Will editorial on the same page. It is headlined, "A Scarlet S for Seditionist." And George Will writes, "The three repulsive architects of Wednesday's heartbreaking spectacle, mobs desecrating the Republic's noblest building and preventing the completion of a constitutional process, must be named and forevermore shunned. They are Donald Trump and Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz. Trump lit the fuse for the riot in the days before the election with his successful effort to delegitimize the election in the eyes of his supporters. But Wednesday's explosion required the help of Hawley, a Republican from Missouri, and Cruz, a Republican from Texas. Hawley announced his intention to object to the certification of some states' electoral votes for no better reason than that there has been an avalanche of allegations of election irregularities, allegations fomented by the loser of the election. By doing so, Hawley turned what should have been a perfunctory episode in our civic liturgy of post-election civility into a synthetic drama. He turned this moment into the focus of the hitherto unfocused fury that Trump has been stoking for many. And Cruz, by organizing support for Hawley among other Republican senators and senators-elect, gave Hawley's grotesque self-promotion an ersatz cloak of larger purpose. Shortly before the mob breached the Senate chamber, Cruz stood on the Senate floor. With his characteristic unctuousness, he regretted the existence of what he and kindred spirits have not only done nothing to refute, but have themselves nurtured. A pandemic of suspicions that the election was rigged. "I want to take a moment to speak to my Democratic colleagues," said Cruz. "I understand your guy is winning right now." Read those Weasley words again. He was not speaking to his colleagues. He was speaking to the kind people who were at that instant assaulting the Capitol. He was nurturing the very delusions that soon would cause louts to be roaming the Senate chamber, the fantasy that Joe Biden has not won the election, but is only winning right now. The Trump-Hawley-Cruz insurrection against constitutional government will be an indelible stain on the nation. They, however, will not be so permanent. In 2 weeks, one of them will be removed from office by the constitutional processes that he neither fathoms nor favors. It will take longer to scrub the other two from public life. Until that hygienic outcome is accomplished, from this day forward, everything they say or do or advocate should be disregarded as patent attempts to distract attention from the lurid fact of what they have become. Each will wear a scarlet S as a seditionist. And here's another local news story. Bloomington Normal Socialist Group calls on GOP chair to quit. This story is Dateline Bloomington. Leaders of the Bloomington Normal Democratic Socialists of America are calling on McLean County Republican Party Chair Connie Beard to step down and for the party to condemn the violence at the U.S. Capitol. Yesterday, our nation watched as a right-wing mob launched a full-frontal attack against democracy, the group said in a statement. In the weeks leading up to yesterday's terror in the Capitol, local McLean County Republican Party Chair Connie Beard used her position of leadership within the party to promote and legitimize the lies of widespread election fraud and a stolen presidency that culminated in the attack and loss of life in Washington, D.C. The statement also called for the party to publicly recognize Joe Biden as president. Democratic Socialists of America leaders also demanded that David Paul Blumenschein, who organized a bus of community members to travel to D.C. to participate in the violent chaos that sought to usurp the democratic process, to withdraw his candidacy for Normal Town Council. Leaders pushed for the Normal Town Council to investigate Blumenschein's role in facilitating the violence in Washington, D.C., and for the business community to boycott advertising with Great Plains Media, a parent company of Cities 92.9, which sponsored Blumenschein's Stop the Steal bus trip. Lastly, Blumenschein's call for local recruits to participate in yesterday's mob action was amplified and promoted by Cities 92.9, the statement said. Beard and Blumenschein were not immediately available for comment. And here's a Q&A from Washington that is headlined, "What the 25th Amendment Can Do." Cabinet has the ability to declare president unfit to lead the nation. This is an Associated Press story. President Donald Trump's role in inciting violence at the Capitol and his long refusal to acknowledge his election defeat are prompting some lawmakers to urge his removal from office through the 25th Amendment. The amendment allows for the vice president and a majority of the cabinet to declare a president unfit for office. The vice president then becomes acting president. The section of the amendment specifically addressing this procedure has never been invoked. On Thursday, a day after pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol, the Senate's top Democrat, Chuck Schumer of New York, called for Trump's immediate removal. What happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday was an insurrection against the United States incited by the president. This president should not hold office one day longer, Schumer said. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi joined those calling on the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to force Trump from office, including Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois. The president is unfit and the president is unwell, Kinzinger said in remarks posted on Twitter. He said Trump must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily. And some questions and answers about the 25th Amendment. Why was it passed? The push for an amendment detailing presidential succession plans in the event of a president's disability or death followed the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. President Lyndon B. Johnson, in his 1965 State of the Union address, promised to propose laws to ensure the necessary continuity of leadership should the president become disabled or die. The amendment was passed by Congress that year and ratified in 1967. Has the 25th Amendment been invoked before? Yes, presidents have temporarily given up power, but those instances have been generally brief and voluntary, for example, when the president was having a medical procedure. In 2002, President George W. Bush became the first to use the amendment's Section 3 to temporarily transfer power to Vice President Dick Cheney while Bush was anesthetized for a colonoscopy. Section 4 of the amendment, which allows the cabinet to declare the president unfit, has never been invoked. How can the cabinet declare the president unfit? The 25th Amendment, Section 4, lays out what happens if the president becomes unable to discharge his duties but does not transfer power to the vice president himself. The vice president and majority of the cabinet can declare the president unfit. They then would send a letter to the Speaker of the House and President pro tem of the Senate saying so, and the vice president then becomes acting president. The president can send his own letter saying he is fit to serve, but if the vice president and the majority of the cabinet disagree, they can send another letter to Congress within 4 days. Congress would then have to vote. The president resumes his duties unless both houses of Congress, by a two-thirds vote, say the president is not ready. Isn't there some other legislation about this? Section 4 of the amendment also gives Congress the power to establish a body that can, with the support of the vice president, declare that the president is unable to do the job. If they agree the president is unfit, the vice president would take over, but Congress has never set up the body. In October, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, announced legislation that proposed the creation of a commission to fill that role. The legislation would set up a 16-member bipartisan commission chosen by House and Senate leaders. It would include 4 physicians, 4 psychiatrists, and 8 retired public figures, such as former presidents, vice presidents, and secretaries of state. Those members would then select a 17th member to act as a chair. After the commission was in place, Congress would be able to pass a resolution requiring the members to examine the president, determine whether the president is incapacitated, and report back. And this story is headlined, Trump Concedes as Ouster Discussed. It's an Associated Press story, datelined Washington. Lawmakers of both parties raised the prospect Thursday of ousting President Donald Trump from office, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that if he was not removed, the House may move forward with a second impeachment. On Thursday evening, Trump conceded to President-elect Joe Biden and condemned the violent supporters who stormed the nation's capital Wednesday. In a new video message, Trump said that now that Congress has certified the results, the new administration will be inaugurated on January 20, and his focus now turns to ensuring a smooth, orderly, and seamless transition of power. He is also speaking out against the violence, calling it a heinous attack that left him outraged by the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem. Trump did not address his role in inciting the violence. Though Trump has less than 2 weeks in office, lawmakers and even some in his administration began discussing the issue of ousting him on Wednesday afternoon as Trump first refused to forcefully condemn the violent assault on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of his supporters and then appeared to excuse it. Senior Trump administration officials raised the long-shot possibility of invoking Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, the forceful removal of Trump from power by his own cabinet. Biden on Thursday denounced the rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol as domestic terrorists, and he blamed Trump for the violence that has shaken the nation's capital and beyond. The riot by Trump supporters who breached the security of Congress on Wednesday was not dissent, was not disorder, was not protest, he said. It was chaos. Pelosi said a threshold was crossed of such magnitude that Trump should not be allowed to make any decisions, and if the cabinet does not act, the House might, she said. There did not appear to be public support for the move, for now, among members of Trump's cabinet, especially after Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao resigned in protest Thursday following the Capitol attacks. No member of the cabinet has publicly expressed support for the move, which would make Pence the acting president, but several were believed to be sympathetic to the notion, believing Trump is too volatile in his waning days before Biden's inauguration on January 20th. While the House could quickly vote to impeach Trump, it is extremely unlikely that Congress could remove the president in the next 13 days. The Senate would have to receive the articles and then hold a trial and vote on them. And even if it did so, the Republican Senate would be unlikely to vote to convict. Democrats are set to narrowly take the Senate when Biden is inaugurated, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell holds the gavel until then. As Pelosi suggested, impeachment was a possibility. Three Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee announced articles of impeachment. Representatives Davis Cicilline of Rhode Island, Jamie Raskin of Maryland, and Ted Lieu of California wrote in the articles that Trump willfully made statements that encouraged and foreseeably resulted in imminent lawless action at the Capitol. The House impeached Trump in 2019, but the Republican-led Senate acquitted him in early 2020. And here's a little bit of state news. State Senator Bill Brady, Republican of Bloomington, a former Senate minority leader and three-time candidate for governor, resigned his seat effective at 11:59 p.m. December 31st. He did not provide a reason. State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat of Bunker Hill, will resign effective January 17th to join the governor's office as an advisor. And now we'll read Susan's Hazlitt's column from the home section. Coming Full Circle with Raggedy Ann. Sometimes life makes a full circle in a delightful and unexpected way. This happened to me recently with events starting more than 50 years ago. In 1966, my grandmother, Dorothy Rittenhouse, gave me a Raggedy Ann doll. It was the traditional model with bright red hair, red and white striped legs, and black eyes. On the chest was a heart tattoo which read, "I love you." The feeling was mutual. I loved Raggedy Ann with all my heart. I carried her everywhere and slept with her at night. My mother even sewed us matching outfits, flowered dresses with white aprons. Somewhere along the line, a mean old dog tore Raggedy, ripping her arms and face. Mom quickly repaired my favorite doll, using black buttons for eyes and red ink for the nose and mouth. I was so happy to have Raggedy back. I cried on her new face, and my tears caused the ink to run just a little bit. At that time, my grandmother had a dear friend named Ann Opperman of Pontiac. Mrs. Opperman was a locally renowned doll collector, and one day she invited us to see her impressive collection. Of course, I brought Raggedy along. The entire house was filled with beautiful dolls from all over the world. Some had porcelain faces and others had real hair. Some were displayed in cases while others sat on chairs. All were dressed in beautiful outfits, and Mrs. Opperman knew the story of each one. Raggedy looked a bit worn compared to these other dolls, but Mrs. Opperman fussed over her. "This is a very loved doll," she said, patting her fabric guest. Some of Raggedy's bright red hair was missing, but Mrs. Opperman acted as if my doll was the prettiest in the room. Years later, Raggedy and I went to college. When I became an adult with a home of my own, Raggedy had her very own shelf. However, at about age 40, one of Raggedy's legs came off, and she was put in a drawer to be repaired someday. That day never arrived. Fast forward to 2 weeks ago on Christmas Eve. "Santa has something special for you," said my husband, handing me a box. I started to remove tissue inside the box when I caught a glimpse of two very familiar red and white striped legs. I burst into tears. In a rush, I pulled my beloved doll out and clutched her to my chest as if I were 3 years old. "You fixed her," I cried. Not only did Raggedy have new legs, but in keeping with 2020, she also had a little red and white striped face mask. "Well, I had some help," he said. "I took her to Dottie." Dottie Barrett, owner of We Sew Shop in Bloomington, is a longtime family friend. We have relied on Dottie and her team of miracle workers for alterations and repairs for decades. "Dottie fix Raggedy?" I asked. And when he nodded, I laughed. You see, I knew something he didn't. Mrs. Dottie Garrett is the former Miss Dottie Opperman of Pontiac, daughter of Anne. Why, Dottie's mother had actually met Raggedy 50 years earlier. I couldn't wait to thank Dottie. "Your husband came in and said, 'I have this doll that needs help,'" she explained. "He didn't know my family's close connection to dolls." Dottie estimates her mother had 300 dolls filling 4 bedrooms and each wearing a special outfit. She quoted her mother, "If you have a doll, you have to have it dressed." "We had a lot of storybook dolls," she recalled. "I am so happy you kept your Raggedy Ann," Dottie said, "and I am glad I got to be part of her life." Sometimes loose ends in life aren't so random after all. Sometimes they're just waiting to be sewn together into a seamless circle of love. And let's read today's Flick Fact. Question: today you can drive Jersey Avenue in Normal, but until 1942, a drive there meant an entirely different thing. Do you know why? And the answer is, then an area not yet incorporated into Normal city limits, that area was instead Maplewood Country Club. The clubhouse sat along Linden near Jersey, owned by Steak and Shake founder Gus Belt. In a 9-hole course that closed in 1942 and then was redeveloped as a residential area in 1943, hole number 3 was a monstrous drive, a par 6, 636-yard hole. And today in history, today's highlight, on January 8, 1998, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, was sentenced in New York to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And on this date in 1935, rock and roll legend Elvis Presley was born in Tupelo, Mississippi. On this date in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson, in his State of the Union address, declared an unconditional war on poverty in America. And on this date in 1968, Otis Redding's single, "Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay," was released on the Volt label almost a month after the singer's death in a plane crash. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part 2 of the Pantograph of Friday, January 8th, 2021. I look forward to reading again with you soon.